The surrounding landscape was as bleak as anything Ewan could have imagined. He drew the people, the buildings, the sky, but his eyes were never far from the door of the inn. Twice more Brenner left the inn and wandered up the main track, then continued out of town into the desert. Her steps were almost aimless, but not quite, and by the third day Ewan had begun to wonder just what she was doing here, why she didn't move along like most of the other travellers who stopped in Jin Reach merely to outfit themselves before they attempted to cross the drylands. Brenner did not visit the few shops that existed for this purpose, nor did she try to buy anything else, not even food. Indeed, except for her strange forays into the desert, she didn't leave the inn at all. This Ewan thought he understood. Robbed of the white sickness that she had suffered before, Brenner was a fairly pretty woman, and when she walked down the street, men turned their heads. She still retained her forbidding aspect. No one tried to speak to her, and no one dared follow her out into the desert. But she certainly attracted attention, and Ewan sensed that this was not what she wanted. She was waiting for something, being careful. Ewan could only monitor her in the daytime, and he had no idea what she did while he slept. On the fourth day after Bradshaw's departure, two more travellers arrived at the inn. They were heavily cloaked, but Ewan sensed no threat from that, for many travellers in Jin Reach seemed to want to keep their business to themselves. Brenner did not emerge to meet the newcomers, so he dismissed them from mind and returned to his drawing. That night there was no sleep for anyone. A storm had welled up above the desert, a storm unlike anything Ewan had ever seen before. Brilliant lightning cracked the sky from horizon to horizon, and the thunder was so strong that it shook every building in the street. Ewan, who was afraid of thunder, knew that he would never sleep through such a storm, certainly not alone in their basement room. He stayed late at the pub, and apparently the rest of the town had the same idea, for every table in the place was packed. The publican was so busy that when Ewan ran out of water, he plopped a full pitcher on the bar and hurried away without even asking for coin. The room was too noisy for Ewan to enjoy drawing, so he merely rested his head on the bar, keeping his eyes trained out the window. Every few seconds came a flash of lightning, long and brilliant moments that illuminated the entire street in blue-white. Despite the thunder, Ewan's eyelids began to get heavy. It was nearing midnight, and he had only stayed up past midnight 3 times in his whole life, the 3 Christmases before he went to work in the keep dungeon. He wondered if the publican would allow him to fall asleep with his head on the bar. The thunder sounded likely to crack the world in two, but even though he was afraid of thunderstorms, Ewan was not as frightened as he thought he would be. Who would ever have imagined that he would leave New London, travel halfway across the New World, and then be able to take care of himself in a strange town? He wished he could have told Dar about it. But Dar was... Ewan sat up quickly. Lightning had flashed again, and though the flare of lamplight on the window glass made it difficult, he thought he had seen a cloaked figure carrying something out the door of the inn. Ewan slid off the stool and went to stand before the glass. He could hardly see anything in the darkness outside, only the barest outline of the inn's facade. Then lightning splintered the sky, and he saw that a wagon stood before the inn, the clear shape of a bundle in the back. Forgetting his paper and leads, which still sat on the bar, Ewan went outside and was immediately drenched. The storm was so loud that he could hear nothing from the pub behind him. He meant to take a closer look at the wagon, but no sooner had he crept out from under the pub's awning than the lightning flared again, illuminating the dark silhouette in front of the inn. Ewan scrambled backward, pressing himself into the shadows. For a moment, There was only darkness. And then the lightning showed him the witch's profile beneath the cloak. Her head swiveled from side to side, reminding Ewan of a dog that had caught a scent. He pressed his back against the wall with all of his might, praying that he was hidden, that those pale eyes could not see him. After an eternity, Brenna left the cover of the inn's doorway and proceeded down the steps. The next flash of lightning revealed the second bundle slung over her shoulder, and Ewan realized, with mounting horror, that the bundle was the size of a man. He had not seen what Brenna had done to Will in the keep, but he had heard plenty of tales in the guard quarters. Elston said that when Brenna had finished with Will, he was nothing more than mince. Brenna climbed into the seat of the wagon and took the reins. She was leaving, Ewan realized, and his first reaction was a vast relief. The witch was up to no good. She might even have killed someone. But she would drive away, out of Jin reach, and then she would no longer be Ewan's problem. When Bradshaw returned, they could leave this awful town on the edge of nowhere and go back to New London, to Ewan's brothers, to the life he knew. But then, his heart sinking, Ewan realized that this wasn't quite true. The mace had told him to keep an eye out for anything unusual, and here was a witch, transporting what looked like people in the middle of the night. More, Brenna was an escaped prisoner. And before Ewan had ever spoken to the mace, he had been first and foremost a jailer. Dar had made him a jailer, chosen Ewan, even though his brothers were smarter and braver, and he had never let a prisoner escape. Ewan looked through the window of the pub behind him, but they were all talking and drinking. Perhaps he could ask the publican for help, but no. The publican would never leave his bar. If only Bradshaw was still here to tell him what to do. But there was no time. In another flash of lightning, Ewan saw that the wagon had already begun to roll. He groped at his waist and found that he still had his knife. No sword. The mace had never allowed him to have one. Ewan wouldn't have known how to use it anyway, and even his knife work was very sloppy. Venner had said so. Not a real Queen's Guard, he thought again. Even real Queen's Guards were afraid of Brenna. But there was no one else. No help would come in time.
I'm going, Dar, he whispered into the rain. I'm going. All right.
He slipped off the wall and began to work his way up the street, following the wagon. When Kelsey woke, she was first aware that her hands were bound behind her, and next, that she was drenched. She was on the floor of a moving wagon, and for a moment she wondered, astonished, if she was still on her way to Mortmain. If the past few months had been nothing but the deepest dream. She opened her eyes and saw nothing, but then lightning flashed and she found relieved that this was a different wagon, smaller. There was a large bundle beside her, and in the next flash of lightning, Kelsey caught sight of a pair of dark eyes beneath a hood. The Red Queen. Brenna. Kelsey twisted around and found a cloaked figure driving the wagon. Kelsey remembered nothing after hearing Brenna's voice in the darkness. There was a smear of blood on the Red Queen's forehead. Had they both been knocked out? Kelsey had taken too many head wounds lately, but it wasn't a concussion that frightened her now. She didn't know how Brenna had gotten free of the keep. But the woman wasn't in Jin reach by accident. She had come for Kelsey, just as she would have come for anyone who had harmed Arlen Thorne. Kelsey wriggled helplessly, trying to judge whether she still wore Tyr's sapphire. She couldn't tell. Would the sapphire even do any good here? Brenna was rumored to be a witch, but her actual powers were an unknown. The wagon halted, and Kelsey closed her eyes, nudging the Red Queen to do the same. Whatever else Brenna might be, she had incredible strength. She pulled Kelsey from the wagon as though she weighed nothing, rolled her from the cloak, and dumped her on the ground. Kelsey slitted her eyes, trying to determine where they were, but even with the brilliant illumination of lightning, she could barely see anything through the driving rain. The soil beneath her cheek felt like sand. They must be in the desert. Brenna grabbed her and carried her some distance from the wagon. Kelsey tried to stay limp, but Brenna tickled her ribs, and Kelsey could not keep herself from an involuntary twitch.
"Don't bother, true queen," Brenna muttered. "I know you've been awake for some time now. Feigning unconsciousness will not serve you."
"What do you mean to do?" Kelsey asked. Brenna did not reply, but the next flash of lightning revealed a wide, bestial grin. She looked different, younger, but Kelsey could not assess the change before the light faded again. A few more steps, and the rain stopped pelting her face and body. They were in a shelter of some sort. Brenna dumped her without ceremony on a hard stone floor, and Kelsey yelped as she landed on her elbow.
"Wait here, little queen. I will not forget you."
Kelsey gritted her teeth and tried to pull herself upright. With her hands tied behind her back, the best she could do was to wriggle on the floor. In desperation, she looked down at her chest and found the sapphire peeking out from her shirt. But no, it was the wrong sapphire, not the one she needed. Tyr's sapphire was not for inflicting wounds. Finn's sapphire would have helped her here, but she'd given it back to the Red Queen. Why had she done that? She could barely remember, and her mind gave her nothing but a flash of Arlan Thorne's face. After another minute, Brenna returned, her grating footsteps tramping across the stone floor. With a thud and a sharp cry, the Red Queen landed beside Kelsey, and then Brenna moved away.
"Who is it?"
the Red Queen whispered. "Brenna, Arlan Thorne's witch."
"Witch indeed. I can't find her at all."
Kelsey nodded agreement. Brenna was like Ro Finn. She had never existed clearly within Kelsey's mind, as other people seemed to. So many children born after the crossing, born with oddities that had filtered down to the present-day Tierling in such unpredictable ways. Magic was all over the Tier, if one took the trouble to look, and so much of it seemed to trace back to that one moment, the ships gliding through the hole in the horizon. But was the crossing really at root? Or was it Tier's sapphire? The sapphire that ran underground all through the Tierling. "What has it done to us?" Kelsey wondered, momentarily distracted. "What has it done to all of us?" A match flared, and she saw Brenna's silhouette across the room, crouching over a pile of sticks. They were in some sort of stone building without windows. Kelsey could hear rain pounding on the wooden roof. The place itself seemed long abandoned. A few chunks of wood in the corner were all that remained of furniture. Brenna straightened, clapping her hands together to clear them of ash, and Kelsey saw that she'd been right. Brenna looked different. Her formerly white hair was honey blonde, and her cheeks were bright with color. "You're no longer albino?" Kelsey asked.
"I never was. People are quick to believe the first foolish glance of their eyes."
"What are you, then?" the Red Queen asked.
Kelsey sensed her playing for time, but what good would that do them out here? Even if Mace and Pen had somehow managed to track them from Domain, they would never find this place. Brenna had not stumbled upon an old abandoned house in the desert by accident. This place had been chosen.
Mort Queen, my master spoke of you often.
Brenna glanced at the fire, which had strengthened, casting flickering shadows on the walls.
We will wait for the fire to build a bit, so we can all see well. Otherwise, this will not be nearly such good fun.
What are you? Kelsey asked, following the Red Queen's lead. Delay was better than nothing.
I am a tool. My master's useful tool.
What sort of tool?
You will not distract me, bitch. But I will tell you as it pertains to the show.
Brenna said the final word with relish, and Kelsey shuddered. She smelled torture here, in one form or another. The woman's excitement was too pronounced for anything less.
Before I could even walk, our handlers in the creche realized that I had a curious talent.
Brenna continued.
I absorb pain, not physical pain, but the pain of the mind, the heart. I could take a man's worst memories, the most terrible things he had done or had done to him, and absorb them into myself. For the hour they paid for, my clients could be free of care.
I suppose people paid a high price for that.
Oh, they did.
Brenna squatted down and checked Kelsey's bonds.
But the relief was only temporary. At the end of the hour, they had to take their pain back.
Ah. Kelsey murmured, seeing Brenna's strange value now. To certain parties, she would be worth a lifetime supply of morphia. And what about Thorn? Brenna slammed the side of Kelsey's face into the floor. Kelsey tasted blood in her mouth.
You don't say his name. I saw what you did. I saw.
Brenna fell silent. In that moment she seemed distracted, but Kelsey could make no use of her distraction. The Red Queen was struggling to sit up, but she was having no more success than Kelsey. Playing for time was all they had left. "What did you do for your master?" Kelsey asked.
"I took his pain and held it."
Brenna's features were clear, almost beautiful. Her eyes were a deep, cold shade of blue.
I never gave his pain back. It leached the life from me, took my youth and turned me pale. But I held his pain so that he could do the things he needed to do. To keep us safe.
Kelsey closed her eyes. She had misjudged Thorn. Categorized him as a pure sociopath, but he was not. He had felt pain when he was dying, great pain, far greater than the wounds Kelsey had inflicted. Brenna had no longer been able to help him.
"So you're a conduit, then?"
the Red Queen asked in tear.
"To drain off pain?"
"Sometimes."
Brenna grinned. A grin so savage that Kelsey shuddered again.
"But I have other talents. My master rarely needed them, but I think we will make good use of them here."
She grabbed the Red Queen by the hair and dragged her into a sitting position. The Red Queen grunted with pain, but did not scream, as Kelsey was sure Brenna had intended.
"You, Mort bitch, my master spoke of many times. You tried to cheat him when you thought you could get away with it. You will make a good demonstration."
"Demonstration of what?"
Brenna squatted on her haunches and stared into the Red Queen's eyes. The Red Queen tried to turn away, but she could not. And gradually, her head stilled, her gaze fixed and pinpointed on something Kelsey could not see, her mouth dropping open in horror.
"I own pain,"
Brenna remarked, almost casually, never breaking gaze with the Red Queen.
"I manipulate it. I can draw pain out if I want. But I can also magnify it."
The Red Queen began to squeal, a high animal squealing, a hog in a slaughtering pen. Kelsey closed her eyes but could not block the sound.
"Think of the worst thing you've ever done. The worst that's ever happened to you,"
Brenna whispered.
"I can make you live there."
The squealing stopped. The Red Queen's eyes had rolled up into her head, her face gleamed with sweat, and a thin line of drool had begun to work its way from her mouth. Her entire body shuddered. "Stop it!" Kelsey cried. "You have no reason to do this to her."
"She cheated my master," Brenna replied steadily. "That's reason enough. But not all. I want you to see what's in store for you, tear bitch. This show is for you."
"Mother!"
The Red Queen howled.
"I think we can loose her now,"
Brenna remarked, straightening. She produced a knife, bent over, and began to cut the Red Queen's bonds.
"She's not going anywhere. And it makes for a better show."
"Mother, I'm sorry,"
the Red Queen screamed. And Kelsey saw that tears had begun to leak down her cheeks as words tumbled from her mouth.
"Please don't. Don't, Mother. I'll be good, I promise. Don't sell me away."
Her unbound hands went to her face, her nails drawing a long set of gashes down one cheek. Blood ran from the wound and began to drip down her neck. Kelsey rolled over and retched.
"Do you have bad memories, Kelsey Glynn?"
Brenna asked softly.
"Anything you regret? Anything you've been trying to run from?"
Kelsey wriggled away from the words, but Brenna was right on her, lifting her head by the hair.
"I will find it. Whatever it is, believe me, I will find it, and it will happen to you again and again until you know nothing else."
Kelsey shut her eyes, determined not to meet Brenna's gaze. Brenna tossed her on her back, and a moment later, Kelsey felt the gentle prick of fingernails on her eyelids.
"Open them," Brenna whispered. "Open them, or I will take them from you."
Several feet away, the Red Queen was still sobbing and pleading with her invisible mother. The sound was terrible, but the thought of being blind was worse. Kelsey opened her eyes and found Brenna's face right over hers.
"Where is it?"
Brenna whispered. And Kelsey realized in horror that she could feel the woman inside her mind searching, prying.
"Where is that thing? That worst thing?"
Is this what I did? Kelsey wondered, appalled. Brenna was working through her mind with all the finesse of a thief, tearing apart a drawer full of clothing. It was like being bludgeoned. Kelsey tried to break eye contact, but she could neither look away nor close her eyes. Did I do this to others?
Buried deep, Brenna muttered.
And Kelsey realized, terrified, that Brenna was drawing nearer to a deep, dark pocket in her mind. Lily's memories, Lily's life before the crossing, constant fear punctuated by staccato notes of violence and violation. Lily's terrible life, which Kelsey had been forced to live as well.
Ah, Brenna murmured with relish, I see you now.
Kelsey gave a tremendous heave, her body arching off the ground, but she still could not break the contact. Somewhere nearby she heard the Red Queen choking.
What do we have here?
Brenna asked, her voice teasing. Her fingers tickled Kelsey's ribs, making her writhe, but Kelsey still could not look away. She could feel Lily's memories climbing up from their dark hole in her mind, scrabbling for purchase, gaining traction. Greg Mayhew, Major Langer, the animal called Parker, soon they would all reach her, and then...
You leave her alone.
Brenna jumped away. The contact in Kelsey's head broke, and she moaned at the mercy of that... The relief of Lily's memories falling back into the darkness of her mind where they belonged. Her eyes were dry and aching. She had to blink a few times before she could focus on the figure in the doorway. There she found the last person she would ever have expected. Ewan, the keep jailer.
Ewan, run!
Kelsey shouted. Ewan had a knife, but his eyes were wide. The eyes of a child afraid of the dark. Kelsey could not have him die here, not Ewan, not when she had already killed so many others.
Yes, get out of here, boy, Brenna snarled. This is none of your business.
That's the Queen of the Tearling,
Ewan replied, his voice trembling.
And I am a Queen's guard. The Queen is my business. You leave her alone.
Queen's guard,
Brenna repeated, her voice dripping with mockery.
You're a plaything to them, a mascot. You don't even have a sword.
These words took a visible toll on Ewan. His white face paled even further, and he took a great gulp of air. But still he raised his knife and took another step forward into the room.
Ewan, don't look at her!
Kelsey cried. The sound of gagging came from her left, and when she turned, she saw the Red Queen throttling herself. With a tremendous heave, Kelsey rolled onto her stomach and began wriggling toward her.
Evelyn!
Staring off into the distance, the Red Queen removed her hands from her throat and reached down. Her fingers hooked into claws, then in a single swipe, she tore a wide gash open on her right thigh. Kelsey tried to kick her hands away but could find no leverage.
Evelyn, wake up!
Mother?
The Red Queen whispered. And with dawning horror, Kelsey realized that the Red Queen was reaching out for her. She scooted backward, but the Red Queen began to crawl toward her, continuing to reach out, her hands grasping at nothing.
Mother,
she croaked, weeping.
I'm sorry I ran.
Brenna had cornered Ewan, and she advanced on him now, slowly, the knife tucked behind her back, a smile stretching her mouth.
Let us discuss this, boy. Come here. Look at me.
No,
Kelsey shouted, but she saw despairing that Ewan was already caught, staring at Brenna with wide eyes and open mouth. Kelsey felt a light pressure on her ankle, looked down, and screamed. The Red Queen was stroking her foot, her mouth upturned in a blood-dabbled smile.
Mother?
Sobbing, Kelsey scrambled away, crawling toward Ewan, desperate to break him away from Brenna. She pulled herself forward on her good elbow, one sliding foot at a time, shouting Ewan's name, but miserably aware that she was moving too slowly, that she would not reach them in time. And then she looked up, stunned, as Ewan's voice echoed throughout the stone room.
I see that you have a knife behind your back.
Brenna's smile slipped. She stared at Ewan for a long moment, eyes wide and teeth gritted in concentration.
You will drop your knife.
Brenna's face contorted with rage, so much anger that Kelsey could feel it across the room like heat. Ewan moved forward, raising his knife, and Brenna's eyes rounded in shock.
You can't, she whispered. You can't be.
Drop your knife,
Ewan demanded again. And Kelsey could only stare at him, wondering if she was dreaming. He was nearly twice Brenna's size, though until a few moments before, Kelsey had been sure that Brenna was the larger of the two, and she retreated before him, backing toward the fire. She stabbed out wildly with her knife, but Ewan remained just outside of her range.
Put it down.
No.
Put it down,
Ewan repeated. His face was like a wall, both stubborn and patient, and Kelsey suddenly got an inkling of what was going on here. Brenna had picked a bad target. There was nothing inside Ewan for Brenna's particular brand of suffering to latch onto, because Ewan was different. Good.
Where is it?
Brenna shouted, her eyes locked on Ewan's face. She stabbed at him again, but this time she swung beyond her reach and lost her balance, falling forward. Ewan made to grab her and she sliced at his arm, then scrambled backward right into the fire.
Grab her!
Kelsey shouted, wriggling wildly. Ewan was trying to pull Brenna from the fire. He let out a cry as the flame seared his hand. Brenna's shrieks echoed through the tiny stone building until Ewan finally succeeded in hauling her free. But her thick dress was flaming and there was nothing to tamp the fire. Brenna screamed in agony as Ewan hovered over her helpless. A stomach-churning smell had begun to fill the air, one that Kelsey remembered well from the Argive.
Roll her! She shouted at Ewan. Roll her on the ground!
Ewan gulped and began rolling Brenna with his feet, trying to damp the fire. But Kelsey knew it was already too late. Brenna had stopped screaming.
Glenn.
She looked down and found the Red Queen lying beside her. Her eyes were only half open, but Kelsey could see a red gleam between the lids. Something awakened inside Kelsey. An atavistic instinct that spoke of danger. But she asked, Are you all right?
No.
The Red Queen gestured toward her body, which was a bloody mess.
But I am back. At least.
Majesty?
Ewan asked in a broken voice.
Majesty? I tried my best. I think she...
Ewan? Come here.
Majesty?
I need you to cut my bonds. Ewan scrambled to his feet and hurried over with his knife. Kelsey wriggled to one side as he began to cut, then her wrists were suddenly free. And she clasped them in front of her and stretched, feeling her shoulders sing in relief. "You listen to me, Ewan," she ordered. "She would have killed me. She would have tortured me for pleasure, and then she would have killed me. And she would have killed you if she could have caught you. But you didn't kill her. You asked a prisoner to surrender her weapon, and she refused." Ewan nodded, but a shadow had fallen across his face, and Kelsey did not think it would be an easy shadow to dispel. "How did you come to be here, Ewan?"
"The captain, Majesty. He sent me here. Me and Bradshaw."
"The magician? Is he here?"
"No, lady. He went to fetch the captain days ago. It's just me."
Kelsey pushed herself to her feet and crossed the room to stand over Brenna. Her body was a blackened ruin, and Kelsey felt a stab of grief. She had despised this woman, but in the end, Brenna's grudge had been legitimate. The truth had been staring Kelsey in the face for weeks. Executing Thorn had been a terrible mistake, and what she had done to him in the process had been even worse. "Ewan," she muttered. "There are cloaks in the wagon outside. Bring them here." Ewan hurried away, his face betraying relief at being given an easy task. Kelsey drew a deep breath and regretted it immediately. The air stank of charred flesh.
"Glyn," the Red Queen whispered again, and Kelsey returned to squat beside her, picking up Brenna's knife along the way.
"When we get back to town," she told the Red Queen, "we'll tend to your wounds."
"No need. Look."
Kelsey looked down and found that the gashes in the Red Queen's thighs were already healing somehow, flesh reassembling itself from nowhere. Ewan returned almost running with the cloaks, and Kelsey directed him to throw them over Brenna's corpse. She planned to cremate the remains, but that was nothing Ewan would need to see.
"Glyn," the Red Queen croaked again. "Send the boy outside."
Kelsey nodded to Ewan, who hesitated for only a moment before he left the tiny house, closing the door behind him. Kelsey turned back to the Red Queen and caught another flash of red in her eyes.
"I am changing," the Red Queen said steadily. "Changing into something else. I am no longer master of myself. Something in my blood tells me to kill you, and I want to listen to it."
Kelsey drew back.
"I could stand feeding on flesh. In some ways I have done nothing else, all the years of my reign."
The Red Queen smiled, her eyes deep red flares.
"But to be controlled by another, never directing my own fate. I lived that life long ago. I cannot face it again."
"What happened to you?" The Red Queen offered a hand, and Kelsey saw Finn's sapphire sitting on the Red Queen's palm.
"Would you see, Glyn? If you would, you must do me a kindness in return."
"Do me a kindness?" The words echoed inside Kelsey's head, and she saw Mern, his upturned face smiling as she cut his throat. She was suddenly frightened, even more frightened than she had been when she had woken and found Brenna standing over her in the dark.
"I wouldn't kill you before. What makes you think I'll do it now?"
It is different, Glynn. Now, I am begging you.
Kelsey shut her eyes. Something pawed at her hand, and she looked down to see the Red Queen prying open her fist, depositing Finn's sapphire into her palm, and then squeezing her hand closed again.
I know what you fear,
the Red Queen whispered. Her eyes glinted red.
You fear to become me.
That was wrong. Kelsey did not want to become the Red Queen, no. But this wasn't what kept her awake at night. What she feared more than anything was becoming her mother.
You should fear it. But death is fluid. There is all the difference in the world between cold-blooded murder and the prevention of agony. And Glynn, I am begging you.
Kelsey looked down at Finn's sapphire. She did not want it, could not wear it, but she could not simply cast it away either. Powerful things had to be guarded. If she was a Tyr, as Finn and the Fetch had claimed, then her family had been guarding such things for a very long time.
I can't kill myself, Glynn. I don't have it in me. But you could, I think, and take no injury from the act. You make yourself into whatever you wish to be.
Kelsey almost winced at these words. Again she saw Myrne, smiling as Corin slid the needle into his arm. At the time, Kelsey had thought it was mercy. But was it really? The Red Queen lay before her, not the clumsy, mangled body, but the woman beneath, outlined in red light. Yet the Red Queen was fading, being overtaken by something else.
I don't have long, Glynn. Look and see.
Kelsey looked and almost drew back in terror. The woman's mind, which had fought her so hard before, was now wide open, a vast roaring metropolis of thoughts and ideas and memories and regrets, sound, sight, feeling, all of it swept over Kelsey like a tide, so strong that she thought she might drown. At the bottom of it all was the mother, trapped in a vast web of contradictory feelings, love, hatred, jealousy, longing, regret, sorrow. The beautiful queen had viewed young Evelyn as a pawn, just as Evelyn herself now viewed others. A cycle that seemed to Kelsey almost inevitable, and the sadness of that idea nearly made her stop and withdraw from the Red Queen's mind. But she didn't, for, as always, the story was the compelling thing, worth all of its sufferings to find out the ending. When Evelyn was 14, the Kedaeris king offered the Tyrling an alliance, a complicated trade involving horses and lumber, gems and gold. The negotiations had been long and complex, dragging on for months. By the end, both ambassadors were exhausted, and the Tyr court was utterly tired of entertaining the Kedaeris delegation, which expected elaborate courtesies and consisted almost entirely of men who didn't know how to keep their hands to themselves. The entire keep breathed a sigh of relief when the two delegations reached a tenuous agreement. And in order to seal the deal with goodwill, the beautiful queen threw in Evelyn, the court bastard, as a gift to the Kedaeris king. Evelyn was used to being treated differently. She had lived with the snide remarks, the praise that others had heaped on Elaine, her beautiful sister, the purebred, while in Evelyn they only seemed to find fault. She was even used to her mother's neglect, which vacillated between indifference and irritation. But this final betrayal... Evelyn had not been ready for it. There was a scene there, an image that would not come clear to Kelsey, perhaps because it existed in a haze for Evelyn as well. A scene of screaming and recrimination and tears and, finally, begging. Fruitless begging that Evelyn remembered only dimly through a dark veil of humiliation. Her mother had not been moved, and in the end, Evelyn had been bundled off with the Cadarees. Her last view of the keep was almost identical to Kelsey's own. Standing at the far end of the new London Bridge, rent with sorrow, surrounded by men she couldn't trust, her eyes drawn helplessly back to her city. But by the time the delegation had travelled out of sight of New London, the sorrow had turned to rage. The Cadarees delegation never made it home. On the third night out, the ambassadors, drunk on a complimentary keg of tear ale and grandiose dreams of the rewards they would receive from the king for completion of their mission, went to sleep without securing the strange, ugly child they were hauling home. She had been so curiously withdrawn throughout the journey that they had forgotten all about her. They had gone through the bulk of the keg, and most of them barely put up a struggle when the child Evelyn tiptoed up, knife in hand, and began cutting throats. A hand grabbed Kelsey's.
"I don't have long," Evelyn whispered. "Please, everything is cold, and my heart."
Kelsey listened for a moment, and found that the woman was right. Her heart was beating, but oddly, sluggishly, as though it were a clock winding down. So many ticks, and then a pause. But there was so much more story to see. Only one man had woken completely, and at the sight of the blood-drenched child, her teeth drawn back like an animal's and her eyes glittering with death, he had fled south, into the drylands, never to be heard from again. The incident had wrecked the Cadarees' alliance, although it was hushed up and very few people knew what had really happened. The popular story was that negotiations had simply failed. Even now, Kelsey could stop and marvel at how well Evelyn had unwittingly served her own future. For if the Tyr and Kader had built a lasting alliance, Mortmain could never have risen to the dominance it had enjoyed. Instead, the murder of the ambassadors, a murder that the Cadarees' king believed until the end had been committed by the Tyr, had soured the relationship between the two countries for years to come. When a young sorceress emerged from nowhere and began to wreak havoc on what was then New Europe, there was no unity, and thus no concerted effort to stop her. But that was years in the future. After killing the Cadarees' ambassadors, Evelyn had fled north, and,
"Please,"
the Red Queen repeated. "Can you not end yourself?" Kelsey asked in desperation.
"I have tried already. The giving in, it goes too much against my grain. My body will not accept that there is no future."
Kelsey believed it. The anguish in Evelyn's eyes was too real. Given the choice, this woman would want to end her own life, to control her death as she had mastered everything else. Even dimly, Kelsey could see the agony it would cost her to put her death in the hands of a stranger. "I don't want to do this," she said, and was surprised to find that the words were true. Evelyn smiled grimly.
"There's a thing my mother used to say. Have is the hell of want." This is where we've ended up. Please.
Help me, Kelsey begged, not knowing to whom she spoke. Barty, Carlin, Mace, Tyr. The Queen of Spades. The thing that had been inside her when she murdered Arlen Thorne, for she understood now that it had been murder. That thing was gone. But there was nothing to replace it. There was only Kelsey. She had wanted to be herself again, but only now did she understand how much that wish would cost. She could feel Evelyn's heart before her, as vulnerable as though it lay in her hands.
"Soon it will stop on its own," Evelyn whispered. "And I am afraid. So terribly afraid. That it will begin to beat for someone else."
Kelsey hesitated, a rogue part of her still desperate to see the end of the Red Queen's story. Ro Finn was there, waiting, and there was so much more that Kelsey needed to know.
"Please," Evelyn repeated, "I am at the end."
And she was. Kelsey felt the woman's heartbeat unraveling. The ghosts of Mern and Thorn seemed to wander in and out of her field of vision, but strangely, Kelsey did not fear them. Katie, too, was there, demanding a share of Kelsey's mind. Kelsey sensed time growing short, and she raised the knife over Evelyn's chest, gripping it in both hands so that it would not slip. As with Mern, she had no courage for a repeat.
"He fears you, you know," Evelyn whispered.
She gestured to Finn's sapphire, now dangling from Kelsey's hand, its dark facets glittering in the firelight.
"Take that and get it done."
Kelsey stared at her, but Evelyn had already closed her eyes.
"I'm ready, child. Don't lose your nerve now."
Kelsey took a deep breath. Their faces were before her again, Mern and Thorn, but Evelyn was right. There were many different kinds of death. "A kindness," she whispered, blinking back tears.
"Yes."
Evelyn's lips lifted in what might have been a smile.
"A kindness."
Summoning everything she had, Kelsey brought down the knife. Book 3. Chapter 11. The Tyr Land. The resurgence of fundamentalist Christianity in William Tyr's town was a great blow, one that Jonathan Tyr clearly recognized but could not counteract. Few things are more dangerous to an egalitarian ideal than the concept of a chosen people, and the divide drawn by the early iteration of God's Church helped to exacerbate the many ideological faults that already underlay the landscape. When the chips were down, Tyr's people were ready to turn on each other, and the fall of the town was very quick. So quick that this historian wonders whether all such communities are not destined to fail. Our species is capable of altruism, certainly, but it is not a game we play willingly, let alone well. The Crossing in Hindsight, Ellen Alcott. In the 2 years following William Tyr's death, Katie Rice had learned many things. She was with Jonathan constantly, and Jonathan sometimes simply knew things. But there was more to it than that. Sometimes Katie felt as though she existed at the hidden heart of the town, a hub where all of the town's secrets were buried, and by now she knew many things, even some she wished she did not. She knew, for instance, that when Lily Tear was in the final extremity of her childbirth, Jonathan and Mrs. Johnson, the midwife, had tried to perform a caesarean section. The results were ghastly, and Lily had died screaming. Katie would hear those screams to the end of her days, but that was not the worst of it. In the last moment, a thought had come arrowing out of Jonathan, the thought limned with despair, and yet so clear and sharp that Katie could almost read it, as though he had written it down. "We are failing." Katie didn't understand this. Lily's death was not Jonathan's fault. If anything, it was his father's fault for failing to return with doctors or even to bring the white ship safely in the original crossing. Though Katie could not truly believe this, not with the memory of Tyr's anguished face upon her. He had already punished himself. No fault could be laid at Jonathan's door. But Katie knew that he blamed himself for his mother's death. No man was an island, perhaps, but Jonathan was at least an isthmus, and Katie did not try to talk him out of his guilt. He would not be comforted, could only work his way out of it in time. Katie knew him well enough to understand that. She knew that two more children had disappeared, Annie Bellum, while walking up from the dairy, and Jill McIntyre, who had been playing hide-and-seek down by the schoolyard, both of them gone without trace. These disappearances were bad, but because of Jonathan, Katie also knew that the depredations in the graveyard had begun again, that 15 graves had been dug up over the past 14 months, all of them belonging to children. The town at large did not know about the graveyard. Katie herself had filled in several of the graves, tamping them down with extra dirt to hide the settling, and covering them with leaves. But after the McIntyre girls' disappearance, the Christers had gotten much worse. Paul Anscott, or Brother Paul, as he now styled himself, claimed that the disappearances were a judgment on the town, a punishment for weak faith. This did not surprise Katie. What floored her was the number of people who listened. It was just as she'd feared. With William Tear gone, there was no voice strong enough to counteract the increasingly hysterical flow of religious rhetoric. Mum and Jonathan were working on it. Jonathan did not quite have his father's ability to sway a crowd, but he could talk a good game when he needed to. His voice, quiet and logical, the voice of a man who only wanted what was best for everyone. But it wasn't enough. 8 months earlier, some 100 people had begun construction of a church. A small, white, clapboard building on the southern end of town, and now that the church was finished, Anscott held sermons there every morning. He had given up his day job of beekeeping, but no one dared remonstrate with him, not even Jonathan. Katie knew many things now, but she didn't know how to fix what was wrong with the town. She hoped Jonathan did, but couldn't be sure of that either. And she had an uncomfortable feeling that the rest of Jonathan's guard was riddled with doubt as well. Gavin was the worst. He complained constantly about the shifts Katie assigned him, how they interfered with his duties to the church. If she had known he would turn out so devout, she would never have chosen him, but she couldn't let him go now. He was still the best knifeman in the group, and Morgan and Lear looked up to him almost as much as they did Jonathan. More, perhaps, Katie's mind often remarked, and she shuddered, feeling that nothing good could come of that. This, in turn, swayed Alain and Howell, who followed wherever the majority led. Virginia remained Katie's staunch ally, but even this felt like a failure to Katie. That she had been able to retain the loyalty of the one woman in the group, but not the men. She didn't know whether it was sexism or not, but either way, she thought that William Tyr would have been disappointed. Sooner or later, she knew Gavin was going to challenge her for leadership.